There was a long silence. "Is that all?" asked Gad, breaking the silence in a low, curt voice.
"Yea, for after that I awakened," replied Joseph, rather crestfallen. His dream had disappointed him in the telling, though in the dreaming it had been strange and gratifying, and even a little frightening, especially the part about Reuben pointing silently behind them. However, the narration had sounded meager, even foolish. In Joseph's opinion, it could not have impressed any of his hearers, and his view was confirmed by Gad's words, "Is that all?" He was ashamed of himself. Silence had fallen again, broken by Gad with an oath, so suppressed that only the first syllables were anything but a whisper. Joseph lifted his head. He took heart. It would seem that his dream, even as he had told it, was not without any effect upon his hearers. "Is that all?" had been crushing. But the oath was full of encouragement. It meant all sorts of things. It meant no little. It meant, "What the devil?" and that sort of thing. He looked into their faces. They were all pale, and vertical folds stood between their brows. Altogether they made a singular impression indeed, as when one gnaws his under lip, or his nostrils go in and out like gills, as many of theirs did. Their breathing came fast and uneven, so that it sounded like an irregular tenfold snorting. And all this went on under the awning where they sat, and if regarded as the effect of his narrative, might well have made young Joseph feel disturbed. And so it did, to a certain extent, but in a way that made the scene seem to him like a continuation of his dream, having, for all its actuality, the same extraordinary character of uncanny joy and joyful uncanniness. True, the effect upon the brethren was not very happy, but it was obviously much stronger than Joseph had dared to hope, so that he was evenly balanced between the sinking feeling he had at sight of them and gratification that his tale had, after all, not missed fire. He felt no different when, after the lip-biting and the snorting had gone on for some while, Jehuda burst out in a hoarse, throaty voice, "A more disgusting piece of nonsense have I never heard in all the days of my life!" For such words could only be an expression, not very happy indeed, of Jehuda's amaze. Then came another pause, filled with pallid silence and gnawing of lips. Then, "Thou brat! Thou jackanapes! Thou poisoned toad! Thou stinking fart!" roared Simeon and Levi both at once. They could not even speak in turn and make a sort of couplet as they usually did, but all mixed up together, with crimson faces and veins standing out on their foreheads. Actually, they displayed the phenomenon reported of them at the time of the plundering of Shechem, for the hair on their chests rose up and bristled like porcupine quills as they roared with one voice, "Thou peacock! Thou swaggering puppy! Thou blackguardly fool! What care we what thou hast dreamed and what seen behind thine eyelids, thou shameless, thou thorn in our flesh and stone of stumbling to our feet, thou stench in our nostrils, that we should interpret it unto thee! Bow down! Bow down! Dah! The falsehood and vanity of what thou dreamest and forcest us honest men to hear. So our sheaves stand in a circle and flop down before thee, but thine standeth upright. And it turneth the stomach as nothing I have before heard in this world. Thou foul, thou filthy sink of abominations, so thou wouldst play the master and lord with us by filching the ketonet behind the backs of thy elders. Thou trickster and thief of the birthright! But we will teach thee all about standing and bowing down, and will show thee thy masters, and thou wilt name to us thy name, and wilt perceive thine own shameless lies." Thus bellowed the twins, and when they had done roaring, all the ten left the shadow of the awning and went out on the field, still red and pale, still gnawing their lips. But Reuben, as he went out, said to Joseph, "There hast thou it, my lad?" Joseph still sat a while, pondering, upset and cast down because the brethren did not believe in his dream. For this was the thing he had grasped of all they had said, that they did not believe him. Had not the twins several times used words like lies and vanity? He asked himself sadly what he could do to prove to them that he had not said a word too much, but only quite honestly related what he had dreamed in their very presence. If they only believed him, he thought, their violent humor would abate, for surely he had shown brotherly good feeling in telling them what God had revealed to him in a dream, that they might likewise rejoice and with him discuss the significance of the matter. It was impossible that they should take umbrage at his confidence in them, and the bond between them, which had been the whole ground of his revealing God's mind concerning him. True, the dream displayed him exalted over them, but that they, to whom he had always in one sense looked up, could find that fact intolerable, would have been such a disappointment to him that he simply could not have thought of it. At all events, he perceived that the harmony between them was destroyed for the day. He did not go back to the field, but went home and found his little brother. To him he confided that he had told the brethren an altogether modest dream, comparatively speaking, the content being such and such, but that the brethren had not believed it, and the twins had been furious, although by comparison with the eagle dream, of which he had not mentioned a single syllable, this one was modesty itself. Tortura was glad that nothing had been said of that monstrous dream, and for his part displayed such delight over the dream of the sheaves that it entirely made up to Joseph for the fact that it had missed fire with the elder brethren. The little one jumped and laughed at the thought of his own small sheaf bowing down with the rest. It so precisely corresponded to his feelings. The Council. Meanwhile, the ten stood on the meadow in the light of the setting sun, and took counsel together in anger and in fear, leaning on their tools. At first they had silently acquiesced in the interpretation given by Simeon and Levi to the dream, namely, that the little liar had made up the whole thing himself. Indeed, they preferred this interpretation, for it fortified their own inward position. It had been Judah who had wanted to explore all the possibilities, and he it was who pointed out that Joseph might actually have so dreamed, as he reported himself to have done, and not drawn a long bow at all. After that, they all explicitly reckoned with the possibility, and thereupon subdivided it into two, namely, that the dream, if actually so dreamed, had indeed come from God. This they naturally regarded as the greatest conceivable catastrophe, or, contrariwise, that it had nothing to do with God, but had originated entirely in the insufferable vanity of Joseph, which, overweeningly nourished by the gift of the Ketonet, had given rise to these visions. Reuben's contribution to the discussion was that if the dream came from God, then there was nothing for it but to pray. To God, of course, not to Joseph. But if, on the other hand, it had been born of conceit, then they could afford to shrug their shoulders over it and leave the dreamer to his folly. In the end, he reverted to the probability that the lad had childishly made up the dream and deserved a beating for the same. Big Reuben, in short, proposed that Joseph be beaten for telling lies. At the same time, he recommended that they all shrug their shoulders, which proves that he was not very serious about the thrashing, for you cannot thrash with any conviction while shoulder-shrugging. And from this, one might deduce that Reuben wished to believe in the second interpretation in order to discount the first and distract the minds of the brethren from thinking of it. Reuben, in short, was afraid that belief in the theory that God had sent the dream would not at all incline the brethren to humility and self-restraint, but rather to conduct infinitely more drastic than mere thrashing. They were not at all prepared, he felt, to view the matter objectively and let their attitude be governed according as Joseph had dreamed out of sheer conceit or had really had a revelation of God's plans for him, for their words seemed to show that in the latter case they did not find his conduct one whit the less worthy of vituperation. If the dream really came from God and was a token of great preferment, then of course there was nothing to say against God, as little as there was to say against Jacob for his honorable weakness. With them, the whole point was Joseph. If God actually preferred him over them and made their sheaves flop down before his, it was because God too had been made a fool of, even as Jacob, and by the same means, namely, the double dealing by which he supplanted them in the father's affections. God was great, he was holy and irresponsible, but Joseph was a viper. It is clear, and Reuben saw it too, that their notion of Joseph's relation to God perfectly agreed with his own view. They considered it the same as his relation to their father. Indeed, it had to be so, for proper hate is only generated on the basis of some common belief.
Reuben was afraid of this train of thought. Therefore, he did not try to defend Joseph by persuading the brethren that God sent him the dream. Rather, he wanted to convince them that the lad had humbugged them and ought to suffer for it, while shrugging their shoulders. But he was, in reality, as little capable as the others of shrugging his shoulders. For even more, perhaps, than they, Reuben knew in the pit of his stomach the sinking sensation to which the downright Gad had first referred, and of which now not only the four sons of the maids, but all the ten were painfully aware. It was a horror springing from mythical and prophetic associations wrapped about such ideas as bartered birthrights, world domination, and fraternal submission. Reuben suffered in his soul more even than the others on the score of them, except that they did not put him in a fury of rage against the lad who was the source of his oppression, but only gave rise to unnameable emotions toward the innocent babble of the chosen one, as well as an overpowering sense of surrender in the face of destiny. It would have been the last straw if he had said, "Bow down," Gadiel said through his clenched teeth.
"He said, 'Made obeisance,'" remarked the bony Issachar, who loved a quiet life and for its sake was willing to make sacrifices. If he dissociated himself at all for the brethren on this occasion, it was because of this pacific leaning of his.
"I know," answered Gad, "but he may only have said that to play a trick, and anyhow, it is just as disgusting either way."
"Not quite," Dan answered. He was a stickler by nature, and never failed to stickle conformably to his nature. "To make obeisance is not quite so much as to bow down. We have to admit that it is really less."
"Why do we?" yelled Simeon and Levi, determined to bear witness to their savage stupidity, let the occasion be foul or fair.
Dan and some of the others, including Reuben, insisted that to make obeisance was rather less than to bow down. The former might happen not out of inner conviction, but as an empty and formal gesture. One made obeisance only on occasion, whereas bowing down was a constant attitude of the heart, which honestly took cognizance of facts as they were. And thus, as Reuben explained, one might make obeisance out of caution and shrewdness, without really bowing down. Or, on the other hand, might actually bow down and yet be too proud to make the gesture of obeisance. Jehuda disagreed. He did not think that the position could be sustained, for that they were dealing with a dream in which making obeisance was the only picture representation of the attitude for which Reuben would reserve the words "bow down." At this point, young Zebulun interpolated that they were now doing the very thing to which Joseph had shamelessly invited them, and which all of them had refused to consider. Namely, they were blithely engaged in interpreting his shameful dream. The comment was so exasperating that it broke up the meeting, amid shouts from Simeon and Levi, that it was all stuff and nonsense, and that one neither bowed down nor made obeisance before such insults, but only took steps to get rid of the author of them, as had been their course at Shechem. Thus the council came to an end, without other result than unappeased bitterness. Sun, Moon, and Stars. And Joseph? He had no notion, of course, of the torment which his dream was causing to the brethren, but thought of nothing else than that they had not believed him, and of how he could carry conviction. Conviction in two directions, both as to the actuality and the truth of his dream. How should he best bring this about? Insistently he asked himself the question, and later was surprised that he had not known the answer, but had to be given it, or rather, that it had given itself to him. That is to say, he had another dream, or rather, he had the same dream, only in a form so much more splendid that the confirmation was more impressive than if he had dreamed exactly the same dream the second time. He was sleeping under the open starry sky on the threshing floor, where he and some of the brothers and hands often spent the night at harvest time, to guard the grain which had not yet been threshed and put into the pits. Very likely, Though this is in no sense an explanation of the source of dreams, the character of his had been influenced by the starry heavens spanned above him, also by the companionship in sleep of those whom he wished to convince. Still another element was introduced by the content of his day, the fact that he had spent hours receiving instruction upon the last things from old Eliezer under the Tree of Wisdom, upon world judgment and blessing time, the final triumph of God over all the powers to which the peoples had so long sent up the smoke of incense, upon the triumph of the Savior over the pagan kings, the planetary powers, and gods of the Zodiac, whom he was to subdue and cast down, shut up in the underworld, and mount above them to a universal and glorious world dominion. Of all this, Joseph dreamed, but in such confusion that he childishly substituted his own person for that of the eschatological God-hero, and beheld, or rather perceived himself, the boy Joseph, as the actual sovereign and ruler of the whole world, as it revolved through the zodiac. He perceived, I say, rather than beheld this, for it would be impossible to reduce such a dream to an ordered narrative, and in repeating it, he had to put it into the simplest and shortest words in order to express the feelings it gave him, rather than to narrate it as a series of events, all which did not help to make it more acceptable to the hearer. He began to be concerned over the form and manner of his communication, directly he roused from his dream and sat up in joyful possession of such striking confirmation of the earlier vision. His concern had to do with the question whether the brethren would give him a chance to tell them another dream. It seemed unlikely. Even the first time it had been a toss-up whether they would not refuse their attention or simply get up and leave the tent before he was done. A second opportunity appeared to him the more unlikely in that they had not seemed to derive unmixed pleasure from the first. It behooved him to find some means to enforce them. And even as he lay upon the threshing floor, Joseph conceived how this might be done. In the morning he went to his father, as he usually did, since Jacob desired to see him at the beginning of each day, to look into his son's eyes, assure himself of his well-being, and give him his blessing for the day. Joseph said, "A right good morning to thee, my father and lord. Lo, here is a new day born of the night, and methinketh it will be a hot one. One followeth another like to a string of pearls, and life is joyous to this child of thine, especially at this season, when we bring in the harvest. It is lovely upon the meadow, whether we toil or whether we rest, and men grow to understanding of each other in common tasks." "What thou sayest is pleasant unto mine ears," Jacob replied. "So it goeth well with you all on the field and the threshing floor, and you come together in the Lord, the brethren, and thou?" "Excellently well," answered the lad. "Aside from small differences of opinion, such as each day of necessity bringeth forth, and the division of the world displayeth them, everything is in the best of order. For honest words, even though they may be rude, help to clear up error, and then harmony ruleth once more. I wish that our father might but witness it, for thou art never there, and often do we regret it together."
"I do not love the field work."
"It is natural, and yet what a pity that the workers get no sight of the master, and no feeling that his eye is upon them. Especially the hired hands, upon whom is no reliance. My brother Jehuda complained to me only lately that they do not sharpen the little wheels on the threshing cart, so that they crush the grain instead of cutting it. But thus it is when the master's eye lacketh."
"I must admit the justice of thy reproach."
"Reproach! May God preserve my tongue from such! It is but a request, proffered by thy offspring in the name of the Eleven. And nobody suggesteth that thou shouldst share our labors, the service of the soil, the work of Baal, but only our midday rest, when the sun is high in the heaven and we break bread in the shade, and talk among ourselves, we sons of the One and the Four, and one or another may relate some jest or dream that he hath had. Often we nudge each other with our elbows, and say how fine it would be to see our father's head in the midst of the circle."
"Ah, well, I will come, for once in a way."
"Hurrah! Come then today, and rejoice the hearts of thy sons. The work neareth its end, and there is no time to lose.
So it shall be today, then? I will say naught to the red-eyed ones, nor blab it out to the sons of the maids, for it shall come to them as a surprise. But thy child will hug to himself in secret the knowledge to whom they owe it, and who hath so cunningly and loyally schemed to bring it about.